reflect, listen, and act accordingly. I think the more we do this in all aspects of our life, the better we are for the people we care about and the communities we care about.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Helping with Dr. Richard Schuster. Food for the brain, knowledge from the experts, tools to win at life. I'm your host, Dr. Richard. Whoever you are, wherever you're from, and whatever you do, this is the show that is going to help you become the best version of yourself. Each episode, you will hear from some of the most amazing, talented, and successful people on the planet who followed their passions and strive to help others. Join our movement to get 1 million people each day to commit acts of kindness for others. Together, we're going to make the world a better place. Are you ready? Because it's time for your Daily Helping. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Daily Helping Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Richard, and we have such a phenomenal guest with us today. His name is Glenn Gallet. He is a thought leader and national voice on the future of philanthropy and social impact. As CEO of the Stupski Foundation, he oversees initiatives advancing food justice, economic empowerment, post-secondary success, and health equity. He is the co-host of the podcast Break Fake Rules and the author of Who Gives?, a newsletter which interrogates the myths and power structure shaping modern philanthropy. There is so much more I could share with you about Glenn, but we're here today to talk about his book, which is available everywhere. It's called Control: Why Big Giving Fails. I've been excited about this interview for a while. Glenn, welcome to the Daily Helping. It is awesome to have you with us today.
Yeah, it's a real treat. We were talking before the show. It's nice to be on the other side of the microphone for a change. So it's nice to be with you, to be a part of your show, and to be a part of your mission, which helping is everything we try to do at the Stupski Foundation. So this is great.
Well, it felt like there was a chocolate and peanut butter potential here going on. So I'm glad that we have that. And hopefully that's the first of many food analogies we'll have together during our time today. So Glenn, what I want to do first, because the work you're doing is so impressive and so important, is I want to jump into the Glenn Gallet time machine. Take us back and talk to us about those seminal moments which put you on the path you're on today.
I think for me, it's always been about justice. It's a value I hold very strongly. And what I mean by that is a general concern about people that have not been given the opportunities that so many of us have, and in some cases, maybe even have been prevented from that. So all of my work, when I was in academics, in political science, I worked on human rights issues across the globe with an emphasis on Africa. When I left the academic world and entered into this philanthropic world, which many of us get into through either volunteering at an organization or giving money to an organization, and then there is a large, pretty large workforce now in the nonprofit sector. I came in through the giving side of that. And I also was in the fundraising side and another organization called Human Rights Watch. So I've always been kind of close to human rights and also in this giving side. And I've had the great benefit of working with thousands of very wealthy people who have made one way or another, they found themselves in a place to give money. And eventually, over the last 10 years, I worked with one family, and you said their name at the start, the Stupskis. And I worked closely with them and just giving what's turning out to be all of their wealth away, and it'll all be given away by the end of next year.
That in and of itself could probably be an episode, because for a lot of people, right, they think about, I'm going to be an entrepreneur and I'm going to build generational wealth for my family and do all these things and this legacy and my kids and grandkids and great, 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 great grandkids. And you're working with somebody who just said, nah, it's all gone. Right, I'm giving it all away. So share, if you could share, because I know we're going to talk about your book and that's important, but I think this is an interesting touch point. Share the mindset of the Stupskis as to why they felt they wanted to do that.
I am so glad you asked. And I think this story will resonate with you in particular because I've read your background and I know your story. Larry Stupski is an unknown person, but he's had an enormous impact on so many people. He is the machine behind Chuck Schwab. So Chuck Schwab, what people know of as Schwab, the finance company, Schwab was originally just a small investment boutique company here in San Francisco. He hired Larry Stupski many, many years ago, and Larry transformed Schwab into an international powerhouse for people to do investing directly. They didn't, no longer would they need to have a financial expert to help them. He was a hard charging person, and in his early 40s, he had a terrible heart attack, and it killed him, and he was saved on the table and came back. And almost immediately after that, he stepped away as president of Schwab. He joined the board, and he started a private foundation. He gave a very large amount of money to a private foundation and dedicated the rest of his life to giving away money and working on education reform. And some of the stories are kind of interesting. I didn't know Larry, but I know his daughter very, very well. She's back on, she's on my board. She stepped away from the foundation for many years. Her father passed away in 2013. And so she stepped away from the foundation world, but came back when her stepmother passed away in 2021. And I've heard a lot of stories about Larry, but the one that I hear a lot is that he started into these various therapies. And one of them was really just trying to be more patient and to try to pause and be more present. And one of the exercises they asked him to do was, when you go to the grocery store, find the longest line and stand in it. And when you get to the register, find the longest line and go stand in it. And I don't know about you, but if there's one place in my life that I get agitated and irritated, it's when I want to hustle through that grocery store. I just thought this thing was so interesting. And apparently Larry talked about it all the time. It was his therapy. It was what calmed him down, and it was what kept him present to do what would be the rest of his life's work, which was giving away money to many, many causes, and then working in education reform.
But Larry took this a step beyond. Obviously, if he built Charles Schwab into what it is, he had a ridiculous amount of cash reserves, right? A lot of people give, and there's great science. I mean, the whole show, my podcast premise is that we feel good when we do things for other people. So I've been preaching that for almost a decade. But he decided to give it all away. Why?
That was a combination. That wasn't just him. That was also his wife, eventually widow and now deceased chair of my foundation, Joyce Stupski. But they did decide together. He ended up, after the heart attack, he had a very bad run with health. He contracted prostate cancer that metastasized into bone cancer and eventually killed him. It took a while, took about 18 years. At the end of their life together, they decided, we're going to give it all away. And they simply were interested. They both came from, they did not come from wealth. Larry grew up in poverty in Florida, and he got into Princeton on a football scholarship. Just a brilliant guy, and went to Yale Law School from there. And eventually, there are a few things in between, but ends up at Schwab. I think he just felt like he nor anyone else associated with him needs that wealth, except for people that he cared about. And, you know, I talk about this in the book, not to bring the book in too quickly here, but in the book, I talk a lot about Carnegie in the outset of the book. And Carnegie is kind of he is the great steel baron from Pittsburgh who really kind of wrote the book that we still follow today in philanthropy. And Carnegie's view was that you're very special if you can make a lot of money, and you owe it to the people who can't make a lot of money to help them. I don't totally align with everything he says there, but he definitely spoke a similar ethic to Larry, that he didn't want to die with a lot of money. He didn't think his kids should get the money. Didn't see any reason for that. Just going to make them spoiled and unproductive. And so he too wanted to give away a lot of his money. I don't think it's documented anywhere that Carnegie wanted to give away all of his money, but he did. He put a ton of money into foundation life and foundations and made them perpetual many, many years ago. So I think Larry just shared that view. You know, he didn't write a lot about this. He wasn't someone that has a lot of tomes of, a lot of these wealthy people like to write their, their story for everyone to hear. He wasn't that person. So well, much of what I hear is just from other people who knew him.
You know, jumping back into your world, Glenn, you know, had the political science world, the human rights stuff, you were in academia for a while, and you really went all in on philanthropy.
Yeah.
And you wrote this book, Control: Why Big Giving Fails. So what was the thought behind writing this book? And then my immediate follow-up question is, why now?
It's funny you're saying Why Big Giving Fails. That was the original subtitle for the book. I think you were around me about 2 years ago. But the actual title is Why Big Giving Falls Short. And I say that because there is a lot of big giving that does well, and we do benefit from it. So this is not like a throw the baby out with the bathwater kind of book. I love the sector. I work in the sector, and I'm frustrated by how it operates. So why now? So when I started the book, I would never have known then, because it was about 2.5 years ago, that we would see such a pullback from government in funding social services like we have seen in the last year. That's enough alone, a big case for why philanthropy needs to do more. But I was looking more at the supply side. So just so people know, a private foundation is a private foundation not because it's private and no one can have any role in it. It's a private foundation because a person gave only one person, a single donor, created an organization. Typically, they name it after themselves, and they put a gigantic amount of money into it. We as the American people incentivize this because we give huge tax exemption to them for doing it. So most of the time when people start a private foundation, they do so for the tax benefit, which is substantial. In some cases, it can be as high as 70%. And so once that money is in there, I argue, and the law would back me on this, that it's public money, because it's kind of a mixing of public as well as private money. And so a foundation is essentially a public device. And I'm calling for us to stay focused on what it means to be a public steward of this money. What does it mean to give money in a way that the community requires? But instead, what tends to happen is that a lot of the people that have these that govern these private foundations, as they sit on the board, it's not their money anymore. What tends to happen is that they run them as if it's their own money. And they do things like invest the money in things that can work against the interests of the mission. Or they don't give much of it away at all. And that's really at the heart of why I started writing the book. We currently have, as a country, if you take all the foundations in the United States and put them into one bank account, that comes to about $2 trillion. And over the next 20 years, it's projected to go to $18 trillion. And at a time when people really need the money around the country, you've got to ask, why isn't it going out? And why are we falling so short for them? And that was really the driver for the book.
So somebody's listening to this right now, and they're nodding their head, and they're saying, you know, Glenn, that makes sense. How does that impact me, and what can I do about it?
Well, first of all, I'm guessing that someone who listens to your show generally cares about other people. I'm assuming that's the case.
You would think, yes.
If you do care about other people, there might be a couple of reasons why you want to care about this topic. One is, you might want to make sure that money that you have deemed as a taxpayer, you have made a decision, whether you know it or not, but every taxpayer in a country has made a decision when it comes to wealthy people. You've said, we've all said, that these wealthy people are really important to our country. They've made a lot of money. They probably made that money in some way that we think is really innovative or unique. And maybe they can transfer that ability into social good as well. So you may have an interest in making sure that they do the job we're asking them to do, because you have personally invested in their ability to do it. Either they would have paid taxes, and, you know, we can have a whole debate about taxes, but whether you like taxes or not, taxes play a big role in providing healthcare in our country, education support, roads, so much more. The list is very long. It's too long to list here of all the ways that tax dollars benefit society. That money, that tax money, is being taken out of circulation and put into a private foundation with the hope that a wealthy individual and their family are going to move it for good for society. That's only possible to happen because of us, of Americans, allowing that to happen. So if you're happy with the job they're doing, then you don't have to listen anymore. You're good. But I'm not. And I think at $2 trillion piling up, I think that's problematic. Now, here's the other part. People who do not get the tax benefit and just give without any incentive required by the American people to give tend to give in ways that I think are fantastic. And I wish we would talk more about it. And I wish wealthy people would pay more attention to how the everyday donor operates. They don't put any restrictions on the money they give. They see a cause in their community and they give to it. They don't put any type of, here's what I expect to get back in return. I need my name on the building. I need to sit on your board. Nothing, none of that. And then also just think about all the people every day while we've been sitting here. Probably millions of people have acted in a philanthropic way, a gesture to their family, to their friends, to their neighbors. They're not going to see any tax benefit for that. So I think there's a lot to learn just from us, from all of us who live our lives every day and give. I think we all have an interest to make sure that the wealthy people in our country give the same way. And so we can all play a role in making sure that big giving does not fall short.
Hey guys, Dr. Richard here. For the past 7 years, I've been privileged to bring you incredible guests who are changing the world and can help you become the best version of yourself. I'm really excited to share with you a new quiz that I created based on my clinical training that will curate for you a custom list of my top episodes and actionable strategies to help you wherever you are on your journey. All you need to do is go to drrichardschuster.com to take it, and it's 100% free. You'll be taking the next step on the journey to unlocking the power of you, and I can't wait to see where you'll go. That was so well stated. Thank you for that. So, Glenn, let's then dovetail off of that and dive deeper into the book.
How would you like to go about that? There's so many ways this book plays out.
I know. I gave you a very open-ended, loaded question, and I realized that as soon as that came out of my mouth. So you've set the stage here in a couple of ways, right? We've established that there's different rules depending on how money is given. And we've also identified that this to me feels like, and this is a very, you know, simplified way of expressing this, this feels like one of those slush funds you hear about in the government. And, you know, the money just sits there uselessly because nobody can vote on what to do with it. It's kind of what this feels like to me as we're talking.
There's so much in what you just said. So there are two sides to this. I won't go too much into one, which is the money is just sitting there.
Right. So let's go to that one, because I think, you know, if there's a way to shift things so that money that's just sitting there can help more people, let's talk about that.
You know, you mentioned my podcast, Break Fake Rules. We talk on the we bring on people all the time who recognize fake rules that we follow in philanthropy and in other parts of society that prevent us from doing good things. Let's talk about a couple of the big ones in the foundation sector. By law, the foundation world is required to give out 5%, only five, of the total amount of money in a given year sitting in your foundation. The rest of it, most likely, it's not guaranteed, but most of the rest of it will be invested to earn more money. And it's invested in hedge funds, mutual funds, real estate speculation, stocks and bonds of individual source, Bitcoin. It can be invested in anything. And the idea behind it is that you will earn more than 5% because there's a fake rule that these foundations need to live forever. So the strategy is give away as little as you can, which is 5%, and earn more than that every year so that you can keep giving in perpetuity. That is not a requirement by law. There's no reason why you have to do that. The Stupskys, as I told you at the outset, said, we're not going to do it that way. And we will have all of our assets out of this foundation next year, at the end of next year. We'll have a little bit left to close us down. So you are not required to do it. But as a result of the determination to do what I call putting perpetuity over humanity, you are putting your assets into things that can be quite counter-mission to what you're trying to do. So for example, We hear all the time of a growing, and we see all the time, and here you can walk the streets and see it, a growing crisis around homelessness and unhoused people. There are a lot of foundations focused on this. They focus on it with 5% of their foundation's assets. You will find other foundations, the same foundations will have some high percentage of their assets in real estate, where they're buying shares into funds that are buying a property all across the country and unhousing people. So it's because on one side of the shop, they're investing the money and they're not talking to the other side of the shop who are trying to help. And you have, I talk about one of these situations in the book where you will oftentimes have the investment team come in to do a presentation for the board where they'll praise and celebrate the fact that they've earned 12, 13% that year, possibly in real estate speculation. They leave the room and in comes the president who runs the grant making side. And he'll celebrate the fact that a few more people are housed now because of the money they gave away with the 5%. So this is our big challenge right here, getting focused on not having to live in perpetuity, doing what the community really wants you to do, which is probably not invest in their being unhoused, and starting to live with the idea that the community gets more involved in how you give.
So this feels to me, it's a public problem in the sense that there's money that's not getting to where it needs to go. There's a communication problem, at least in terms of conflicting ideologies, right? It seems counterintuitive to have a company that focuses on homelessness buying up shares of companies that kick people out of their homes, you know, and there's disconnects all over the place. Plus, there's a disconnect with leadership of these organizations as well. So it seems like we've got to fix this in a whole bunch of different places concurrently.
That's right. And what I'm arguing for in the book, I'm very uncomfortable about getting into a policy discussion about this, not with you, but I mean, in general, I think policy can become very partisan. And these organizations, foundations are, as you may have seen, on the left, they worry about the Koch brothers. And on the right, they worry about Soros. And this gets very, very ideologically split. So I try to keep policy out of the conversation. I don't know what would happen if you required them to give more money or you required them to do certain things with the foundation. So this book is all about the mindset of control that shows up, the way people control these assets to their own benefit or to their own sense of what's needed, rather than going out to community leadership and saying, what do you need to succeed? For example, my guess would be if you went to a community that's facing massive levels of unhoused people, and you said to them, here are some options. We could buy more real estate with most of our assets and unhouse more people, or we could put more than 5% of our assets into getting people housed. What would you prefer? I'm guessing the community would say, let's go with the housing one and away from the unhousing one. And if more donors listen to that or were aware that their investments were doing the opposite of what they're trying to do with their grant making, I think we'd have a better outcome. And that's not a hard thing to do, but it would require pulling down the fake rule that you need to live forever. Because if you take your money out of the housing system and put more into the people that are unhoused, you're going to have to give more than 5%. You're not going to earn as much, and you're going to start to see the money go away, which is fine. That's its purpose.
And I know that your book has a dialogue that really speaks to a mindset shift in leaders. You know, when I see something like that, I recognize that that's something that's as applicable in the boardroom as it is at the dining room table in somebody's house with the kids. So talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, and I think in reading your story, I think you too, you went through a mindset shift at some point. You say on your website, I read all about it, that you were going in one particular trajectory in life and some events happened and wham, you're going a different direction. And look where you are today, helping people with your show and many, many other ways all the time. And to be fair, I think a lot of people that start giving money at high levels, when they realize, oh, that thing I set up with my estate planner called a foundation can be used for more than just tax protection, I can do it for good, they start coming into this with good intentions. But what they're not doing, and to your point about we can all do more of this, I don't think there's a tremendous amount of reflection on how we show up and how much control we want over decision making and how that can have negative consequences or unintended consequences. So part of this book, when you ask the question, so that open-ended question earlier, let's talk about the book. The reason I struggled to answer is because we approached the book in three different ways. And one of them was to tell my story, to tell the foundation story, and to talk about the sector more broadly. And my story was, when I first came into philanthropy, I skipped this when you asked me earlier, you know, how did you get into this? My first 15 years working in philanthropy, I was a strong believer in donor-centered strategy, meaning donors should give to their passion, they should give to their focus, they should give to things that they care about. And when I was hired by Joyce Stupski to run the Stupski Foundation, that's what she wanted me to do, to come in and build a strategy that made sense to her. And within just a few years of doing that, I started to hear, well, first of all, we did an anonymous survey of our grantees. And they told us, you're not very good at this. We are not experiencing you in a positive way, and you're not listening to what we have to say. And that message started to hit me over and over again. We talked to racial justice organizations. We talked to human rights organizations. And they were all saying, we don't really work with foundations all that much. They don't listen to us. They don't seem interested in us. And they give money to things that do not help us. And I was stunned. And I started doing some deep reflection. I brought the organization into deep reflection. And we identified that we were being way too controlling. And we started challenging ourselves to let go. And to fast forward, now that same anonymous survey, we did it again last year, total 180. So much appreciation for how we show up, how supportive we are, how much money we give, how we give much more than they wanted, than they asked for. Very responsive to the community, very supportive of well-being in the community, and just very responsive to the ideas of what people know work in a community versus what we thought worked before. And I think that's a huge thing for any leader to take into consideration. It's hard to step back from something. You hire all these tremendously talented people to work with you. The interview processes can go on for months, and then you bring them in and control their decision-making when you really want them doing it. So I think there's a lot to learn about pulling back, being reflective, really figuring out what value you really add to a team, as opposed to trying to control one or control the outcomes of a grantee or a community.
I like this a lot. And I said it before, but hearing it come out of your mouth, it's absolutely applicable to you, whether you're a solopreneur, a mom, a dad, a softball coach. These are things that are critical. I want to give some space here as well. Glenn, you mentioned it. I said it in the intro. You've got this podcast. Tell us a little bit more about the podcast.
It all started because we were having internal conversations about the fact that we were spending down. And we thought, hey, maybe there's a way we should be doing philanthropy differently than people that are intending to be around forever. And we started to push each other, and we identified some of what I've already mentioned today, these fake rules. And it gets very technical into foundation life, so I'm not going to put people through the ins and outs of the policies that we put on grantees. But I can tell you that we put a lot of restrictions on grantees. I'm sure you have people listening to this show who have gotten a grant, either from the government or from a foundation, and they probably have to submit a lot of reports. They have to create a different report with all the same questions that they got from another foundation. They end up spending a lot of time administering to the needs of the foundation. And all of that we call fake rules. So the show initially started as a way to bring on people who have done the reflection, recognized where they have been engaging in some restricted behavior, undermining their own impact and undermining the impact of the grantee, and trying to figure out ways that they could step back and get better outcomes. And so we've had so many people on talking about this. And then we decided, hey, what fake rules exist beyond philanthropy? And we've just had all kinds of people on who have talked about how stepping back, letting go, breaking down the myths that their sector uses has had great outcomes for themselves and for the industries they work in.
Outstanding. The book is called In Control: Why Big Giving Falls Short. So yeah. You got to write that down.
You got it. You nailed it.
Glenn, I've loved our conversation today, talking about your book, talking about philanthropy. As you know, I wrap up every episode by asking my guests just this one question. That is, what is your biggest helping, that one most important piece of information you'd like somebody to walk away with after hearing our conversation today?
reflect, listen, and act accordingly. I think the more we do this in all aspects of our life, the better we are for the people we care about and the communities we care about.
Well said, Glenn. The book, as I said, is available everywhere, so you can pick that up today. But if somebody's listening to this and they want to learn more about you, where can they find you on the internet?
Well, they see a lot of me on LinkedIn. I don't know how much people use LinkedIn out there. We are on there all the time. I'm constantly putting information up. And of course, you can always go to our website, www.stupski.org. You can find out more about the foundation and the people who work there.
Perfect. And for those of you in the car, we got you covered. Everything Glenn Gallich and the Stupski Foundation, we will have linked in the show notes, drrichardschuster.com. Glenn, I have so enjoyed our time together today. Thank you so much for joining us on the Daily Helping. It was a great conversation.
Thanks so much for having me. Real honor.
Absolutely. I appreciate that. And I appreciate each and every one of you for taking time out of your day and listening to this. If you liked it, if you're going to think about giving a little bit differently, if you're going to read this book, go give us a follow and a 5-star review on the podcast app of your choice, because that's what helps other people find the show. But most importantly, go out there today and do something nice for somebody else, even if you don't know who they are, and post it in your feed using the hashtag MyDailyHelping, because the happiest people are those that help others.